You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 13th to the 19th of March 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter Jack Grove, deputy news editor John Morgan and writer Matthew Rice. A speech by the new immigration minister James Brokenshire has prompted fears that there could be a savage reduction in the recruitment of overseas students. More on that in a second. Academics on 0 hours contracts have been talking to Jack about the personal and professional cost of precarious employment. So that's our cover feature this week. And Matthew has been speaking with John Carey, Emeritus Merton Professor of English Literature at the University of Oxford, literary critic and author of a new book entitled The Unexpected Professor, An Oxford Life in Books. First though, John, you had the splash this week. A new immigration minister has come into position. His first speech didn't exactly fill university leaders with optimism.
No, this is the speech by James Brokenshire, who's the new immigration minister, who has variously expressed unhappiness with Vince Cable, middle-class people who employ foreign tradespeople, academics who don't like doing immigration checks on their students, and he's also heralded a possible further crackdown on the visa rules that universities must observe. So in the speech, he said that the tolerance threshold of student visa refusals that education institutions are allowed before they lose their highly trusted sponsor status could come down. At present, it's 20% of total visa applications that universities are allowed to have refused for students, and that could come down to 10%. And yeah, Mr. Brokenshire said it was that threshold may be too generous and we may need to look at it again. And I've spoken to an immigration consultant who advises universities and other education providers. He used to be director of managed migration at the Home Office, and he said he wouldn't be surprised to find that there were some universities hovering around the 10% refusal figure that Mr. Brokenshire would like to bring the threshold down to. So that raises the prospect of universities possibly losing their licences to recruit overseas students, which would be a repeat of what we saw in 2012 when London Metropolitan University was stripped of its highly trusted sponsor status by the Home Office, and that was a decision that had huge repercussions, not just for London Met, but for British universities as a whole, because it's widely seen to have sort of affected the views of overseas students about coming to the UK, just making them worried about, you know, what is their position if they come to the UK and they're affected by a decision like this.
He was quite dismissive of those concerns. There wasn't even Mr. Brokenshire in the speech. I think we had a piece online as well. He dismissed as myth and fiction this concern that the visa policies could somehow harm the reputation of UK universities.
That's right. He said it was a ludicrous fiction to suggest that immigration policy is harming recruitment of international students at the UK's quote-unquote world-class universities. So maybe he thinks it's okay to harm recruitment at universities that aren't world-class. I spoke to Edward Acton, Vice-Chancellor of the University of East Anglia, who's always outspoken on visa issues, and he said that statement was by Mr. Brokenshire was very embarrassing, and actually there's stark and completely compelling evidence to suggest that universities are being harmed by current policy.
Yeah, the London Met decision cost London Met almost £40 million, about a quarter of its income. I mean, that's how much its income fell in that 1 year. Just shows how catastrophic it can be for universities.
Sort of potential existential threat to an institution, isn't it? Particularly if it was a smaller one, and it wouldn't just be the affected university that was damaged. I think it would be the standing of the sector as a whole.
Worrying reading, page 6 for that story this week. Jack, you have this week's cover feature. It's all about 0 hours contracts. A lot of talk about this. You've actually been speaking to some of the people on these contracts and finding out what they think.
That's right. We've been hearing a lot about 0 hours contracts in the news over the past 18 months or so. It was actually a term that no one really spoke before then, and it's really caught on. And the focus has always been on places like Sports Direct and Burger King, where these contracts are used. But I've been speaking to some academics who've been on these 0 hours contracts. And the people I've been speaking to aren't PhD students who are just doing a few hours teaching here and there, or student ambassadors. These are established academics who've got, you know, a lot to offer, and they just found being on a 0 hours contract leaves them open to all sorts of abuse. Things like, some people claim that they were being paid, well, they knew of people being paid half the amount paid to equivalent staff in an institution. And also things like, really basic things like, being paid on time. And so you work your hours in a month, and then you expect to be paid maybe the following month for those hours. In Sheffield Hallam, which was mentioned, the payment was coming 3 or 4 months afterwards, and this obviously causes big problems in terms of finances. And you can't really, and people on 0 hours contracts say you can't really make a big fuss, you can't sort of rock the boat too much, because have no security, and then you just don't get any more hours, and there's no real comeback on that. So this is one of the issues that was being raised. But lots of really interesting issues. I mean, I spoke to an academic who was teaching philosophy at Oxford on the PPE course, and she said that she was being paid £15 an hour, not given any extra hours for marking, preparation. Mm-hmm. This is someone who'd had a previously a tenured contract, had to give it up for various reasons, and then had taught philosophy at many of the top universities in the world, and she was being paid about £600 for, you know, just for a whole term's teaching. It was really, really awful. Mm-hmm. And also, these people are really on the periphery of the universities. Often they don't have their own offices, they don't have there's no real sense of belonging. And so it's a really interesting issue, and no one really knows how widespread it is. There's the UCU are claiming that about 24,000 people, according to their survey, are on 0 hours contracts, but UCEA, which represents universities, say the figure is much lower. So it's very hard to actually know how widespread the problem is.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an issue that came out on the Best University Workplace Survey as well. In fact, obviously there's been industrial action over pay recently, but you know, job security actually sort of came out of that survey as being a bigger concern than pay was. It's a really interesting thing to come out of that particular piece of work. And it's a shame, isn't it, really? You mentioned Burger King and Sports Direct, maybe sort of corporate sort of organisations you think might use those contracts. But you'd think universities might be in a position to take a slightly higher ground on this, certainly a slightly higher moral high ground, and lead by example.
Yes, but universities' finances are quite squeezed, so we're told, and there's not really much financial incentives to pay your teachers huge amounts when all the money and prestige comes from research funding, which is a point made by David Palfreyman in my piece. So, you know, is there really a big incentive to have well-paid, tenured academics teaching students when you could have a huge army of people doing the same job on a lot less pay, and you're able to employ them as and when you need them?
Don't the employers say that actually, for some lecturers who work in professions outside higher education and just do lectures fairly casually on a flexible basis, 0 hours contracts can be pretty useful? Some people might be quite sad to see them scrapped if they got banned.
Well, I mean, I think that is the case. I mean, I imagine some places like the LSE, you've got, you know, some top economist coming in from the city to do, give a, like a masterclass, and that's great. But the people I was speaking to, they were working full-time jobs. They were working, you know, they were teaching, doing proper academic jobs, and they were often doing massive amounts of overtime. And they just didn't have any job security. Even after 5 years doing a full-time job, they had no security when their hours just plummeted to 1 hour a week. So in that situation, I think you know, you have to look at and see whether a zero-hours contract is really fair on the staff. But in some situations, obviously, it can be very useful.
Mm, absolutely. Interesting read. You mentioned there some zero-hours contract workers have no office. Matthew, you went up to Merton College, Oxford, to meet John Carey. I read in your piece that he doesn't have an office anymore, being emeritus.
He can now work from home, yes. So his memoir is called An Oxford Life in Books, and he came to Oxford, I think, 60 years ago this year, and has never left, and he's now almost 80. And it's the story of his life, which has been mainly within Oxford. And, the university he joined now seems like a pretty strange place. I mean, English literature degrees finished in 1832. There were, you know, these very learned people in some of these colleges who were also famous for their collections of clockwork cats, and one had a dog which would knock over the chessboard if the opponent seemed to be winning. And, when he wanted to be a postgraduate post, he was interviewed by people who didn't really believe in research, thought literature should be just read for pleasure. And after a brief interview, it was out onto the croquet lawn. So it's kind of, a portrait of this old Oxford and how it's changed, which he very much feels that it has changed, and that he has always been very much arguing that it should change. And he's a grammar school boy, and the book is in some ways a sort of him to the grammar schools which essentially no longer exist. And he doesn't like Toffs very much, so he has. It's in a way a strange that he's spent his whole life in Oxford, but he does emphasise both that it has changed almost beyond recognition, and that he has always fought for those changes himself.
Class division very much at the heart of this piece, I imagine at the heart of the book as well. One quote I picked out, he said, "I don't like to see people coming to Oxford who are not serious about the subject. If you come here for social reasons, because daddy came, or because friends from school are going, or because of the social cachet, I think it's unfair to the kids from poorer backgrounds." Was that a sort of theme that he was beating with you a lot?
I think this is something he's very concerned about, yes. And one of the reasons he's very much approves of the kind of tutorial system is that, you can't hide. If people are posh or rich or well-connected but dumb, it still emerges. And if people come from, you know, much less privileged backgrounds but really have insightful things to say, that comes out as well. So, that is one of the things he's pretty concerned with.
Very good. Well, page 44 for that this week. That's all for this Issue Review podcast. There's a second podcast this week. I recorded a short piece at the JISC Digital Festival on the importance of visualising data to getting that research noticed by policymakers. You'll find that where you found this podcast. Also, you can get us on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Google+, all the usual places, if there's anything you want to comment on about this week's magazine. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.